From NPR and WBUR, I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Washington has been in upheaval for weeks with a failed health bill and an ongoing Russia investigation. But now adversaries are pausing to unite around goodwill towards Senator John McCain. President Trump said in a statement that he and Melania are sending thoughts and prayers. And on Twitter, President Obama called McCain one of the bravest fighters he's ever known, adding, "Cancer doesn't know what it's up against. Give it hell, John." John McCain has been diagnosed with glioblastoma, the same virulent cancer that took Senator Ted Kennedy in 2009 and Joe Biden's son Beau in 2015. We wanted to hear more about glioblastoma. Dr. Barbara O'Brien is assistant professor of neuro-oncology at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. Dr. O'Brien, what sounds particularly vicious about this cancer is that a tumor can be taken out, but it always comes back. This cancer can't be cured.
That's right. There is no cure for glioblastoma. Glioblastoma is, as you said, the most common and the most aggressive of the primary brain tumors. A primary brain tumor is a tumor that begins in the tissue of the brain and remains there. And with our optimal therapies, surgery, radiation, and chemotherapy, there is no cure, at least yet, but our goal is to prolong the patient's survival and quality of life.
Yeah. And when the tumor does grow back, which it always does, we understand, surgeons operate again. So it's not as if they leave it at that. But talk about how this brain tumor was discovered late last week. We know Senator McCain thought that something just wasn't right. He had surgery to remove a blood clot above his left eye, and there are reports that surgeons took some tissue as well. McCain left, but he was called back because of what they found in that tissue. Could this have been found some other way? I mean, was the blood clot just a coincidence, do we know?
It's hard to speculate. Mm-hmm. Typically, when someone is diagnosed with a glioblastoma, they've been experiencing some symptoms, usually for a very short period of time. That could be headaches, seizure, difficulty with speech, even weakness on one side of the body. Sometimes, and it's not very common, these tumors are discovered incidentally. In other words, when a patient is undergoing brain imaging or surgery for another reason. Brain imaging is essential for the diagnosis of glioblastoma. If the tumor is suspected, the patient will typically undergo an MRI scan of the brain. And if a suspected tumor is seen, the next step is for the patient to undergo surgery. Mm. The neurosurgeon would take out some tissue, and a pathologist would look at that tissue and confirm the diagnosis of glioblastoma.
Yeah, which has happened in this case. Look, and I know you don't want to comment on it. It's not your case, not your patient. But there is speculation now that kind of confused questioning from John McCain during the James Comey hearings might have been because, as you said, this cancer can sometimes lead to difficulty with speaking. So there are new therapies, right? There are experimental therapies. What's being looked at?
Right. So right now, the standard therapy after surgery is radiation and chemotherapy with a pill. But we do have exciting therapies in the pipeline. Immunotherapy is a very hot topic. So is targeted therapy, going after the specific mechanism of an individual person's glioblastoma.
And when you say immunotherapy, what do you mean?
These are drugs or therapies that are used in an attempt to ramp up the immune system. They've been really successful in cancers such as melanoma, for example. And we don't know quite yet how much benefit patients with glioblastoma will have from immunotherapy, but that's where a lot of the research is directed right now.
Earlier this year, there was a report about human stem cells being used to kill off the glioblastoma. There's talk about using the polio virus to fight the glioblastoma. But we understand that one reason that it is so difficult is that there may be a tumor, but as a cancer, it tends to web out throughout the brain tissue.
That's true. Unlike some other cancers, it's impossible to truly completely remove glioblastoma because it does tend to infiltrate or spread into the normal brain tissue.
Again, you can't comment directly on someone who's not your patient, but from your sense of this cancer, do you have a sense that Senator McCain might even be able to continue for a little while as senator? Or, you know, because of the nature of this cancer, would you expect him to step down immediately? What's your sense?
It's really hard to say. Uh-huh. Every patient is different. Some patients are able to continue on with their usual lives for some time, and for other people, whether it's due to the cancer itself or the treatment of the cancer, they really need to slow down their activities.
Yeah, so we'll see. Dr. Barbara O'Brien, Assistant Professor of Neuro-Oncology at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. Dr. O'Brien, thank you.
Thank you.
The refugee crisis has fallen from the headlines, but it's not over, not by a long shot. Thousands of people are still fleeing conflict in their home countries, such as Eritrea, Somalia, and especially Syria. They're on a desperate journey to get to Europe, or try to get there. The United Nations Refugee Agency says this week that more than 2,000 people have perished so far this year trying to cross the Mediterranean to get to Italy. Last year, the death toll was more than 5,000. The BBC's Rami Rahayam went out to sea with a team from the aid group Doctors Without Borders as they tried to rescue people making the crossing. He's now in Beirut. Rami, where did you go, and tell us what you saw?
Well, we set out from a port in Italy, twice actually, on two missions with Doctors Without Borders, once from the port of Reggio Calabria in southern Italy, and the next time from Palermo in Sicily. What they do, these search and rescue boats run by charities, is that they head towards what they call the search and rescue zone, which is just outside Libyan waters, and they wait. They wait for boats pushed out to sea by smugglers filled with migrants and refugees to come to arrive to that area. Usually these boats are overcrowded, they are unseaworthy, very unsafe, have very little chance of getting to Italy unless they are picked up.
And they know the boats are going to come?
They never really know when the boats will come, but they know that they are coming because the flow has not stopped for quite some time now.
Describe how the rescue takes place, what the workers for Doctors Without Borders did that you saw.
Well, the first thing they do once they spot a boat is they send out their own speedboat from the ship in order to make first contact with them. And that first contact is crucial because since the boats are so overcrowded, it's so easy that they capsize. And if they do capsize, many of the people on board cannot swim. So it's perfectly possible for people to drown just meters away from a search and rescue ship. So the first thing they do is calm them down, try to stabilize the boat, and then they hand out life jackets. Once everybody on the ship, on the migrant boat, has life jackets, then they start the process of pulling in that boat towards the ship, and then they pull them out one by one on board their own ship. Once they have a certain number of people, then they start making their way back to one or another of the Italian ports.
And how far is that journey back to the ports?
Well, it's usually about 2 days, but it all depends on which port they go to. And that depends in turn on the Italian authorities. So obviously Sicily is the closest, but Sicily itself has many ports, some in the north coast, some in the south coast. But usually, roughly, it's about 2 days from the search and rescue zone until they get back to Italy.
The UNHCR said this week it wants $420 million to try to stop the flow of people, these people who are risking their lives to try to get to Europe. How likely is it that it'll get that money? And if it does, what would it be used for that could really make a difference?
Well, they're talking about improved access to asylum, both in sub-Saharan Africa and in Libya. But they're also talking about aid to the Libyan authorities. And that's something that's in line with EU policy, for example, of funding the Libyan Coast Guard, for example. And the Libyan Coast Guard's mission is to intercept these boats at sea before they cross Libyan waters and take them back to Libya. So this is a very controversial policy because for many reasons. One of them is that the Libyan Coast Guard has been known to have an abusive relationship with people they intercept at sea, and also because of the question of whether it is okay to send people back to a place that they are almost literally dying to escape. One of the stories I heard from a Syrian refugee, he told me that the Libyan Coast Guard approached the boat he was on, and they just boarded it simply to rob the people of whatever money they managed to hang on to. And he saw two people, two other migrants from sub-Saharan Africa, when they saw the Coast Guard approaching, they jumped off the boat. So they appeared to prefer to almost certain death at sea to the prospect of returning to Libya. So that policy has come also under a lot of attack. But at the same time, the Italian government is under huge pressure. No other EU country has accepted to open its own ports for at least some of these ships. And the EU's response has been to try to seal off that route in whatever way they can.
That gives us your story there about the Libyan Coast Guard gives us a better understanding of why more than 2,000 refugees and migrants have been reported dead or missing as they try to cross the Mediterranean. Rami Rahayem in Beirut, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Turn left at the next exit.
Are you using a travel app this summer? We have a cautionary tale.
If you're fond of sand dunes and salty air.
I was lucky enough to book a trip to Martha's Vineyard off Cape Cod this summer, driving from Boston to the Cape to the ferry. Off-season, that's about 2 hours. Summer, we knew to double that. The Cape is separated from Massachusetts by a canal with two bridge crossings, one that takes traffic from Boston and further north, the other from the south, Rhode Island, New Jersey. A couple of miles before each bridge, you slow down and crawl, usually for about an hour, the price for entry to paradise. But on this day, we noticed tons of cars zipping past us on the shoulder, taking an exit. My nephew got on Google Maps. Hey, it's a shortcut. Let's go. So we did. Zipping along on a rural road, at one point crossing over the highway that feeds that second bridge, the Bourne Bridge. But hey, why drop down? We're cruising. Until we weren't. We came to a halt on a side road about a mile from the second bridge. It was 1:30. Our boat was at 4. Did I mention that the ferry reservations to Martha's Vineyard are sold out about a year in advance and that people would give up a firstborn before a ferry reservation? But hey, our travel app said just 30 minutes to the ferry. It was now 2, boat at 4. How bad could this be? Very. Mother Nature was calling with no porta-johns. A fight broke out a couple cars up. 3 police cars came, sirens blaring. We begged them, get us out of here. No can do, they said. Then the lovely Sydney pulled up. A 20-something local, 3 hours late for work. Follow me, she said. I know a shortcut. Well, my nephew would have followed her anywhere, so off we went. Through a neighborhood where people appeared to be, what, waving? No, they were not. They were shaking a certain finger. I had the sickening feeling that as trapped as we were trapping them too, just as we ground to another complete stop. We were now closer to the bridge, but not moving at all, and this time in someone's neighborhood. It was 4 o'clock, we'd missed our boat. I reminded the nephew that with refugees around the world trying to get somewhere, ours was a very first world problem, but still decided to walk a half a mile or so to see what the problem was. Now, visualize a capital T. The top of the T was another backed-up side road, inching toward the entrance to the bridge. Few were letting them in. We were the stem of the T. No one was letting us in. So I began running back and forth, asking the top of the T, please just let one car in, and then running back to the stem, you're next. Between the Nissan Sport and the red pickup, you're in. Back and forth for 2 hours. The traffic started moving. My nephew soon pulled up. People had been giving him money out of gratitude. He should not have taken it. We gradually moved over the bridge, got to the ferry, where over 40 cars sat. We heard over 70 missed their reservations the night before. We got one of the few slots on the last boat, available only because some other poor slob was stuck in the same jam. I don't know what everyone else did. But total travel time? 12 hours. I blame myself for not sitting in traffic like everyone else, waiting my turn. But should I also blame the apps?
Turn left at the next street.
Shut up. Whole cities are trying to ban travel apps for what they're doing in neighborhoods. Let's bring in Professor Mark Hallenbeck, director of the Washington State Transportation Center at the University of Washington. He's in the studios of KUOW in Seattle. Professor, me, the app. Where does the fault lie?
It's shared. If you want anything, it's the tragedy of the commons. It's everyone trying to make decisions for their own self-interest often winds up in causing harm to the public good.
Okay, well, I've already taken full responsibility for my self-interest. But I say that the fault really is in the apps. They don't work anymore because once everybody is going to the shortcut, it's not a shortcut anymore.
That's absolutely right. So welcome to traffic engineering. We used to call it the Wile E. Coyote theorem, which is basically the coyotes running along the mesas of New Mexico chasing the roadrunner, and they run off the edge of the cliff, and they're fine in midair till the coyote looks down. And as soon as the coyote looks down, there he goes, right? And so what happens is Waze or Google or whoever, the apps, look at the road and say, oh, this works fine. And they send you to places and volumes of traffic that are beyond what the road is meant to be. And then something goes wrong. In your case, it was the T intersection. It can be an accident. You create your own backup, and then the backup actually is its own bottleneck.
But then my colleague, Karen Miller-Metzen, drove to Canada. There was a 3-hour delay at the Vermont-Canada border. Waze backtracked her to another crossing so small that it was just a guy at a house with a gate that he lifted. She went through, saved 3 hours.
So do you like to gamble? What's happening in those two different situations were enough people wanted to take your cutoff on the way across a bridge that you blew out that road. And once it blows out, life is bad. Mm-hmm. And particularly on roads that aren't designed for high volume, they don't recover well. So you fell off the cliff. You're with the coyote and you went, and that's the way it's going to be. And she is the roadrunner. You know, things kept going. She could equally have had that same experience if 200 other people had followed her down those roads.
Or if it was a neighborhood. And this is where, I feel the guiltiest. You know, as you looked around and realized, oh my gosh, these people can't go to work. They can't leave their house, and they live there.
That's a huge problem with Waze and other apps like it. When you have a grid street system, when the main road breaks down, the apps, since they're just looking at data, they look at it and say, oh, you can go this way, and we send you in those directions. And the people who go there tend to be the most anxious and therefore the fastest drivers, and they drive through the neighborhoods, and the neighborhoods don't like this. So wars on apps take place. People in the neighborhood who are starting to be overrun with cut-through traffic invent accidents and post them on Waze to have Waze say, oh, there's an accident there. And then drivers quickly figure out that those accidents aren't real, and then Waze has to go out and block the people who are submitting false accidents. But the neighborhoods are saying, hey, this is a neighborhood. My kids are playing in the street. Don't drive through here. The drivers who are mad and being stuck in congestion are saying, it's a public road. I should be able to drive through there. And so then you wind up with cities building traffic circles and chicanes and other things in order to physically slow traffic down.
We're reading about these battles. USA Today writes about Fremont, California, just north of San Jose. They've got big signs that they've put out, don't trust your apps. Some of these cities are closing off the streets. You're not allowed to go during commuting times, for instance, down certain streets. In other cases, they are working with Waze.
So if you're working with Waze, and if they can, Waze can change the attributes of a particular road in order to indicate that it's slower than it is otherwise, to discourage people from taking a particular route. At the same time, there are the traditional traffic engineering things. As I said, you can put in traffic circles. If you're in Seattle, Seattle leads the nation in traffic circles to prevent people from driving through neighborhoods very quickly. And the speeds that people travel are slow. Waze, Google capture that slow data, and they say, wow, that road's pretty slow. We're not going to send you that way. It's better to sit on the main arterial, even though it's going to be three lights.
Yeah.
You also have cities fighting pass-through traffic. There's this conflict between the people and businesses who live in an area and the people who are trying to traverse that area to go to their own activities, which are on either side.
But there are unintended consequences in all of this. And in this case, I'm reading about a San Francisco neighborhood where the city spent, over a year, over $3 million, reconfigured an intersection. This is at Bosworth and Diamond Streets in Glen Park. heavily used. It's got bikes, pedestrians, kids and parents going to an elementary school, the stop for buses, a BART subway stop. They widen the sidewalks. They put in a planted median, everything to slow it down and make it better. And as a result, people started using their mapping software and started going into the narrow streets that people lived on outside the intersection and avoided the intersection.
This is one of the great concerns of traffic engineering. The answer you want depends on who you are. Are you the person trying to drive through? Are you the person who lives along the street? Are you the person who lives next to that street? And so what you're going to find is that the traffic engineers who are trying to balance between what these different diverse groups want, which are often mutually exclusive, is they're trying to find a balance where they're trying to send the right amount of traffic in the right places at the right speed. The difficulty in the app world is the app world isn't part of that community discussion. Waze isn't in the room. And Waze's software, Google software, Apple software, pick your navigation software, they're running a giant international system. It's not tuned to what's happening in Fremont or what's happening in Westchester County. In some cases, it works really well. When it works really badly is when the volume overwhelms the alternative routes.
You have likened this to efforts to dam small streams.
Water, the water is going downhill, right? And you can try to dam it up, and that's fine so long as the dam is bigger than the backup of water you create. Waze works until you back it up beyond the levee, and then your city is swamped.
And you have the crazy lady at the base of the Bourne Bridge. Mark Hallenbeck, director of the Washington State Transportation Center at the University of Washington. Mark, professor, thanks so much.
No problem. Happy to help.
So, do you live on a block trying to block app traffic, or maybe do apps work for you? Let us know. We want to hear your story. Meanwhile, to those very nice people in that neighborhood in Bourne, Massachusetts on 4th of July weekend, I'm so sorry.
This Here and Now podcast is sponsored by ZipRecruiter, making it quick and easy to find quality candidates. Instantly post your job to over 100 job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Plus, get access to over 6 million resumes. Select, screen, and rate candidates with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard and find the right hire fast. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 100 companies and thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. Get started for free today at ZipRecruiter.com/here.
Say, how'd you like to own your own basketball team? You may have heard of it, the Houston Rockets. The Rockets announced this week that they're up for sale, but you'll have to dig deep in your pockets to add this team to your portfolio. Let's crunch the numbers now with Mike Pesca, Here and Now sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com and joins us now. So, Mike, we're not even talking millions here, are we?
Well, we're talking thousands of millions, which is how you get to billions. So the Houston Rockets are valued. I mean, here's the thing. Forbes puts a valuation on teams, and it's calculated by revenue and expected revenue and a premium based on the scarcity of NBA teams. You know, there's only 30 of them. And they come up with a little more than $1.5 billion. However, when the Clippers went on sale a few years ago, they weren't valued even that high, but Steve Ballmer bought them for $2 billion. Now, Ballmer would say, you know what? I still have he's the ex-CEO of Microsoft. Still got $30 billion in the bank. This is an enjoyable purchase for me. So we're not really sure how much they're worth. The team hasn't gone on sale for a while, and it could break someone's bank. It could.
Yeah, and it didn't quite seem to break the bank for Leslie Alexander, who purchased the Rockets back in 1993. How much did they go for then?
It was a good buy. He bought them for $85 million, right? Wow. And then immediately they win an NBA title and then another. And I looked it up. If he had just invested his money in, say, the stock market and index fund and also invested dividends, people forget that when doing the calculation, he'd have done well, you know? But still, the Rockets would be, if he had taken that tack, the Rockets would, the Rockets are worth twice as much as he would have made otherwise. NBA teams, especially with the contract they just signed for television, and also with the specter of legalized gambling, the value of them, I would say it's incalculable, except we're going to get a calculation when someone buys this team.
So what do you mean, bring in the idea of legalized gambling? How does that drive up the value of the teams?
The NBA commissioner, Adam Silver, has embraced this. Some of the league commissioners fight against it, but he says it's coming. We should embrace it. We should capitalize on it. So, for one thing, the NBA will probably get a taste or a slice of however, once they authorize their teams to be bet on. But there's another idea that even the worst game of the year, if a lot of people bet on it, will draw a lot of interest. And that's one of the reasons why the NFL is so successful. Even games between two bad teams have so much money bet on them. And when it's legalized gambling, he thinks and the owners think that this will drive the values up. It might not, though. And Leslie Alexander's a really smart guy. And he might be saying, well, right now, the perception of how much an NBA team is worth has never been higher. So that's why he announced he's selling them now, perhaps.
Does that mean that all NBA teams are valued this high?
Not all of them. I mean, the Rockets are right now, if you look at the odds, they're supposed to win the second most games in the NBA after the Golden State Warriors, who are seen as all but unbeatable. They're a very good team.
And, getting better.
Excellent management.
Yeah, getting better based on what they're doing in the
offseason. They have Chris Paul. Their GM, Daryl Morey, is one of the best in the game. They're an excellent asset. People might not realize Houston's the fourth biggest city in the United States. Absolutely an excellent asset. But even the New Orleans Pelicans, which Forbes says is the least valuable team, I mean, the value of that team could push $1 billion. Sports franchises, no one's making too many more of them, especially the major sports. And right now, say, neither of the Google guys own a sports franchise, don't know if they're interested, but that drives up the price of these assets.
Mike Pesca, Here and Now sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Nice to speak with you, Mike.
Yes, good to speak with you.
People leading double lives are in the news. You may have heard about Dr. Carmen Pugliafito, the former medical school dean at the University of Southern California. He stepped down from his post last year. This week, the Los Angeles Times reported that he led a secret life of heavy drug use, including methamphetamines. Well, yesterday, the current dean told stunned students that the school is launching investigations. Then there's journalist Eileen Zimmerman's ex-husband, Peter. He was a successful patent lawyer in Silicon Valley, a good father, her good friend, even after they parted. But he was acting oddly. Eileen thought maybe he was stressed or overwhelmed by his work as a lawyer. But he was also a drug addict. She found him dead from an infection related to IV drug abuse. And as she recovered from her shock and grief, she also found a web of drug abuse in Peter's profession. Her story for the New York Times was titled "The Lawyer, the Addict." She joins us now from New York. And Eileen, we are so sorry you had to go through this.
Thank you.
Yeah, what a terrible loss.
Yeah, tough 2 years.
Yeah, but what you've discovered is also pretty shocking. Take us back first, though, to that moment when you walked into this room. You had a key. You were that close. You knew something was wrong. And finding him on the floor.
Right. So I think what was the most shocking was that there were all these glaring red flags. And I think because he was wealthy and white and well-educated and lived in this posh neighborhood, it just, you know, IV drug abuse never even entered the mind. We had every other explanation for it. Maybe he had an eating disorder. Maybe he was hiding AIDS. Maybe he was bipolar. We just couldn't think of it. But my kids had a bad experience that previous week where he was so sick. He was sort of almost barely conscious.
This is Peter, your ex-husband.
Peter,
was, yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. And I actually, a few days before he died, my son was on the phone with me. And I said, does Dad want me to come up and, like, make him some soup? And my son said, no, trust me, you know, he doesn't want any help, because he had already just yelled at him because my son had tried to take him to the hospital. And 2 days later, we couldn't reach him. And I just thought, well, too bad. You know, I'm going to go up there and I'm going to drag him to the hospital. And I got there and instead I found him that he died on the floor. And it just, it was horrible. You know, he looked troubled and I couldn't figure it out.
Well, even though there were half-filled syringes on the bathroom sink, there were spoons, lighters, crushed pills, white powder, tourniquets.
Yeah.
Even when it was in front of you, you couldn't see
it. I know. So I think my brain just saw only what it could see.
Well, and you just said something telling, because even though this opioid epidemic has been crushing the country— You said a couple of things. You said, well, he's white, and there had been a perception that, you know, heroin was something that only hit inner city black communities, and many inner city blacks are, you know, responding to that because they were devastated by a heroin epidemic decades ago, and there was not as much attention paid to it. And now the profile has changed, and yet the profile is still maybe young people in small towns in Ohio, not a lawyer in Silicon
right.
Valley.
And I just want to clarify, I'm showing and admitting my own racial bias.
Sure, your own bias. Well, and there were other signs. I'm reading in the article, one day your son watched him open a package, a delivery from Amazon of tourniquets and gauzes, and it just doesn't occur. So now you start recovering from this pain and this shock, and you start thinking about his life as a lawyer and how overworked he was and how stressed he was. And you start digging in. What did you find about the lawyering community?
Well, lawyers are using lots of substances to prop themselves up in an incredibly punishing profession, especially at big law firms. And so lawyers were taking all kinds of pain medications for physical pain, sometimes for back pain, for tendonitis, for carpal tunnel. But then I think it feels good, so they kept taking it just to kind of get through the day and then get to sleep. But then, you know, they need something to keep them going. So there's a huge amount of over-prescription of stimulants in this country. One doctor I interviewed said that this culture of productivity, especially in law firms, is really problematic and really toxic.
Well, the Hazelton Betty Ford Foundation and the American Bar Association did a survey. They asked more than 12,000 lawyers in 19 states about their substance abuse and alcohol problems. Many were far more forthcoming about the alcohol abuse. And the study's lead author, Patrick Krill, told you he thought many were afraid to answer that. And he spoke with NPR's Yuki Noguchi last year and said lawyers and judges have twice the addiction rate when it comes to opioid abuse than the general population does. Let's listen.
The more of a professional stature you have, the less likely you are going to be forced into recovery. And, you know, the longer your addiction is probably going to go on unchecked.
And this is what you started to find.
Yeah, I did talk to other attorneys, and I talked to a judge who had been a heroin addict and several that had been opioid addicts. And, you know, they all said that they would never have admitted it if they hadn't been caught. That it just one guy said to me, he didn't make it into the story, but he said, if you admit you have a problem, he said, there's 10 guys standing behind you ready to take your place because it's so competitive.
Well, in fact, you even talk about the law school culture and quoted people saying that people enter law school with a certain set of values and a certain level of compassion and humanity. They come out the other side without it. It gets stripped out.
I know. It's so sad. And I hadn't realized that. Yeah, but that was a professor, Andy Benjamin, and he said he did something like 7 studies, and he said they all showed the same thing.
Yeah. Well, a 1990 study showed that lawyers are more likely to be depressed than people with other jobs. You spoke to Will Miller, who practices family law in Bellevue, Washington. He said, you know, being a surgeon is stressful, but it's not the same because you don't have another surgeon across the table from you trying to undo your operation. In law, you are financially rewarded for being hostile. And so you and other people are putting together that this is what is leading to this drug use in the lawyering community. And I want to hear from somebody that you met. This is Brian Cuban. The name is familiar. He's the brother of Mark Cuban, you know, the owner of the Dallas Mavericks. Brian is now in recovery for alcohol and drug addiction, but he told you he had trouble getting help. He said, I'm a lawyer. Lawyers don't go to rehab. That was his thinking. And he spoke about how lawyers have trouble asking for help when he was at the annual meeting of the State Bar of Texas. This is last month.
There is a distrust of telling people in law firms. Do law firms have systems put in place? A lot of them don't, even though there are huge risk management consequences, potential consequences for lawyers who are, you know, who are left to their own devices, who are have problems with drugs and alcohol.
Eileen Zimmerman, that's, you know, what you were talking about.
Right.
I'm imagining that's a little heartbreaking too now, that, you know, your husband must have had this thinking, I can't ask for help. I'm a lawyer.
Yeah. And in fact, I felt like it's a shame that Peter had to die for someone to be able to say what he was saying for so long. Like, I can't keep doing this. I don't want to do this the rest of my life. This is going to kill me working like this. You know, and the thing is, he sort of missed that the whole point of working hard in any profession is for the life.
Yeah. To have the life, right.
He kind of missed the life. He missed so much of stuff with his kids because he didn't make it, or he was working, or he was on a business trip. And I mean, I understand. It's hard to imagine anybody that worked more than he did, except other attorneys.
Well, you know, there's not a lot of sympathy for lawyers because they can be ruthless and they do make a lot of money. What would you want someone to know about your ex-husband, Peter?
He was really dedicated to his clients. I mean, almost to the point where it was a pathology. Like, if they called, he left whatever we were doing. He would miss any meeting for a client, you know, work on a vacation. And I think that single-minded dedication, you know, really served his firm and his clients well. He was really good at what he did, but at what price, you know?
Mm. But what has been the response to your article?
Oh, my gosh, it's been insane. I've been getting lots of people and lawyers saying, thank you for writing this. I was girding myself for a really negative backlash about exposing my family. But the kids and I felt like then otherwise he just dies and it's the shameful secret and nothing changes. So we all agreed it would be a good thing to do for the profession and the world. Mm. You know, and I've even seen on some of these threads on Hacker News, and the guy, one person wrote on one of these blogs, he wrote, I've been taking benzos and Addies to stay awake and stuff. And he said, I don't want to wind up like Peter. Mm. And I was thinking like, no, you don't. You know, you don't. Mm-hmm.
That's Eileen Zimmerman, a journalist, writer, and editor, and friend and ex-wife of Peter, an attorney in Silicon Valley who died of a complication from drug use. Eileen, thanks so much for talking to us about it.
Thank you for having me.
And by the way, Eileen notes the American Bar Association has lawyer assistance programs in every state to help with addiction issues. There's even a helpline for judges helping judges. There's confidential help for law students and lawyers. As Eileen said, the problem is admitting it, but there is help. We'll link you at hereandnow.org.
This is a story about some revered food traditions and how they can clash with what we now know about health and nutrition. The story takes us to the Navajo Nation in the American Southwest. It's spread across three states. If you visit, it won't be long before you see a sign for fry bread. Fry bread is fried dough, as greasy as it sounds. It's a Navajo staple and is also a source of pride, but it is not a good source of nutrition on a reservation the U.S. government has labeled a food desert. And there's a push to cut back on food such as fry bread in the Navajo diet. Laura Morales from the Fronteras Desk at Here and Now contributor KJZZ reports.
Marlena Jones is sweating. She's making fry bread for 40 people at a Cameron Church function. She rolls up a ball of white flour, shortening, and baking powder, then claps it between her hands until it's as big as her face. She then stretches it thin and lays it on a pan of bubbling grease. That pan sits over an open fire on a 90-degree day.
I used to make it every day because my kids love it.
Yeah.
And after I found out that I did have high blood pressure and stuff, I kind of cut down on my greasy stuff. So,
Jones found out she was a candidate for type 2 diabetes.
It is scary once you hear it that you have diabetes. But after I cut down, you know, everything came out to be, you know, back at normal.
So you don't have diabetes?
Mm-mm. But it was hard to get my blood, you know, to where it should be, my sugar level.
Uh-huh.
It scares you because I have eight kids.
Eight?
Wow. I have eight kids. And I try not to, you know, feed them all the greasy stuff every now and then now.
Mommy?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Mommy?
Yes, baby?
I eat the bread.
Yeah, a piece of bread right there, baby.
Fry bread was born out of tragic necessity. In the 1860s, the U.S. Army forced 10,000 Navajos and Apaches to a prison camp in Fort Sumner, New Mexico, some 300 miles from home in northern Arizona, in what is today known as the Long Walk. Colonel Kit Carson said he was trying to, quote, tame the savages. Manly Begay is Navajo and a professor of indigenous studies at Northern Arizona University.
Navajo people were basically given tin meat, lard, sugar, salt, and flour. And that became the staple diet.
After 4 years of imprisonment, the federal government let the Navajos return home to Arizona. But Begay says there wasn't much to come home to. Their crops and animals were gone. So the government supplied the Navajo with rations of tin meat, lard, sugar, salt, and flour. Fry bread remained a staple.
We have a complicated relationship with fry bread. You know, it's a sort of a symbol of perseverance. You know, we persevered from concentration camps to survival. And then, you know, it's a source of pride, a symbol of pride at powwows, at rodeos. People identify with fry bread as me, as native. Then also you have pain, you know, because of the high rates of diabetes, you know.
Fry bread isn't just a metaphor for an old problem. It remains a problem today. It still serves as a staple in Navajo homes. 1 in 3 Navajo people suffers from diabetes, according to the Indian Health Service. Obesity rates are 3 times the national average. The U.S. Department of Agriculture has labeled the entire Navajo Nation a food desert. There are only 10 grocery stores on a reservation the size of West Virginia. 2 years ago, the tribe put a 2% tax on junk food and sodas and a 5% discount on fresh fruits and vegetables. Incidentally, the ingredients for fry bread aren't affected by the incentive. Still, many say they don't have the money to buy fresh foods, and fry bread is cheap.
It's a tragic necessity when you don't have much money, when there's high unemployment rate and there's social ills and historical trauma issues to deal with. You know, often that's all you could eat.
Navajo chef Brian Yazzie says the solution is simple. Navajos need to return to their roots, to pre-colonial times before the long walk.
We can look beyond fry bread. You know, we can look beyond that and open their eyes to our ancestral food. Squash, beans, and corn.
Yazzie lives in Minnesota, where he cooks and caters indigenous food. But when he visits his family on the Navajo Nation, he's always offered fry bread.
I came to terms to where it's okay to deny and, you know, say thank you, but no.
And what's their response? Do they give you any flack for that?
Especially with the with the elders, it's a term of disrespect.
But Yazzie says it starts a conversation. And that's where he hopes the change can begin. For Here and Now, I'm Laura Morales in Flagstaff.
And this note about the ever-evolving healthcare story. Some U.S. Senate Republicans have suggested that they will work with Democrats to craft legislation on healthcare after Republicans failed repeatedly to pass a bill on their own. But that plan is also on an uncertain path. That story and all the day's news today on All Things Considered. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.